All right, everyone, let's get the show started. Welcome to our DevOps office hours. It's April 7th, 2021. My name is Eric Osterman, and I'll be leading the conversation. I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. We're a DevOps accelerator, and that means that we help companies own their infrastructure in record time by building it together with your team while showing them the ropes. So if that sounds interesting, head over to cloudposse.com/quiz to get started. Again, that's cloudposse.com/quiz to get started. For those of you new to the call, the format is very informal. My goal is to get your questions answered. So feel free to unmute yourself at any time if you want to jump in and participate. If you're tuning in from our podcast or YouTube channel, you can register for these live and interactive sessions by going to cloudposse.com/office hours. Again, that's cloudposse.com/office hours. We host these calls every week. We'll automatically post a video recording of this session to our YouTube channel. So if you enjoy our content and want to support it, please hit those like and subscribe buttons. We'll also follow up with an email so you can share it with your team. So with that said, let's kick it off. A couple announcements. Every week, right on cue, 10 minutes before office hours, HashiCorp releases Terraform. And this is the latest RC2 just came out. Okay, 43 minutes ago. 10 minutes from when I captured it. Looks like just a minor bug fix here. So it's looking like by next week, my guess is 0.15 will drop by next week. So that's cool.
They just released 14.10 just
And they
now.
released 14.10. All right. What's new in 14.10? Only rewrite provider locks if the content has changed. All right, so super minor enhancement. All right, other announcement I saw come through my news. For those of you who've been following this for a little while, you know, there was the container platform wars. They're still shaping out, but the original platform out there was Mesos. And looks like, yeah, it was just the topic was just broached that maybe we should put this into the attic. So, you know, Apache has their incubator and their attic, and then their main, I forget what you call it, mainline projects. So that seems to be the nail in the coffin for Mesos. Another announcement, this was actually last week, I didn't pick it up, but it's pretty cool. Amazon has announced auto-tuning capabilities for Elasticsearch. So depending on your kind of traffic for the cluster, different parameters need to be tuned if you're write-heavy versus read-heavy. And they have the ability to do some changes online as well as other changes during your scheduled maintenance windows. And those are the ones where it's going to do an actual blue-green flip. For large Elasticsearch clusters, those blue-green flips, those can be incredibly slow. So I really wonder how well this will work in practice for
And
the
deadly.
most. Right? Yeah. I mean, I've seen these things take over a day. So it's crazy. Terraform support for this feature, I was just checking, isn't out yet, but there's already the issue from our very own TD Tim Malone. I saw posted here, so and it looks like a pull request for this auto tune feature is incoming. Somebody has a work in progress here as of yesterday. So that's the cool thing with open source, how fast this stuff is moving. Anyone excited about the auto-tune stuff in Elastic Search?
For me, it just say that it's error and nothing else. I enable it; it says it's error, and I'm not sure
Oh,
what's
when
going
you
on.
tried using it already.
Not sure what's going on. I haven't read about it much. I thought that I would just enable it, and it didn't work for me. Maybe for someone else.
Oh, by the way, Maxime, seems like the gain on your microphone is turned way, way up. So there's a lot of like static when you talk. All right. Yeah. Shh, All right. So the
I
other
guess,
thing.
oh, sorry, I was just going to say one thing about that is that
I haven't looked closely at it, but hopefully they have some sort of windowing and upper and lower bound settings for that, because without that it would be pretty scary.
That would be, yeah.
Yeah.
Do they have it? I didn't check,
I
but
don't know. I didn't actually look. I saw the announcement. I hadn't had a chance to
yeah.
check, but that was just like a gut reaction. Like I looked really quickly, but I didn't see anything. But hopefully they have that.
There's so many announcements. An announcement I missed, possibly because I'm less hands-on sometimes, is that RDS has storage auto-scaling. I missed that at some point. That's kind
Yeah.
of cool. I turned that on, and that has the upper limit you can set for that.
I did see that.
Does anyone know when the RDS storage auto-scaling came out?
Looks like June 2019.
Okay, so it's been out for over a year. Eek. All right. The other thing, the announcement, I think it's less exciting for our demographic of immutable terraformers out there. But AWS did announce serial console access. If only they had this, 10 years ago, before I was using Terraform and had all my pet servers out there and stuff that I wanted to debug. But with this, just like your, KVM, you can connect and attach to the serial output of an EC2 instance. Useful for when that server's borked for one reason or another. God knows, I had those issues back in the day, upgrading kernels and stuff like that. Another, this is why we can't have nice things. GitHub is fending off a crypto mining campaign. It's pretty ingenious behind the scenes what's happening. A lot of open source repositories have actions that run on pull requests. So this is not even like injecting malicious actions into the repos. They're literally just opening pull requests against these public open source repos with actions, and the act of opening the pull request kicks off the action and is running their crypto miner. So I imagine that's using up a fair bit of resources. Thanks for sharing that one, Andy.
I'm actually kind of excited about this because it's hopefully going to mean better first party support from GitHub on, deciding whether you want your actions triggered manually or not whenever it's from a fork. Like I have to, like I use Codefresh for this, and there's a bunch of steps that you have to do to make it configured properly, so I can write slash test or whatever in my comments.
And just in general, better support by GitHub of spam. I mean, there's a few repos I've been in that just get attacked. Helm file has been attacked a bunch of times with just comment spam and PR spam. So maybe this will fall into that category. Whoever muted. Sorry, go on.
Just abolish Hacktoberfest. You'll get rid of a bunch of it.
Yeah, that too. Yeah. Whoever thought you'd need antivirus on your GitHub pull request, so to say. All right. The other one, I mean, this one, I don't know why this didn't get more attention. First of all, it just hurts that the technology that powers such an insanely significant portion of the web, something like 70% of any website where we know the technology running the website, it's basically WordPress. And of those, the WordPress core has been hosted for decades now on their own Git server. Of course, it was going to get hacked. Who does this anymore? And a project this large. Yeah, it was just inevitable, I have to say. So yeah, somebody was able to hack it, presumably using the maintainer's key, and injected a backdoor that operated on a particular keyword of a header in the user agent, and did it more than once. They patched it, they fixed it, and they just injected it again. So. So they are officially flipping over to using GitHub as the canonical source for the WordPress project. About time. Any comments on that one? Or any additions?
You said it. It's about time, right?
It's about time. It's so annoying. You come across some of these projects and they're using some other Git platform, and it's just so annoying to contribute. I hate it. And I'll be a snob. I'll say, honestly, like, dude, if you open source project, just use GitHub, common platform. I know GitLab is nice for something, but come on, can we just, I just want one place. I want it to be GitHub.
What about SourceForge?
I know, right? Back in the day. Oh my God. Oh my God. I haven't heard that for like 10 years. All right, cool. And just a reminder, if you like what we do here at Cloud Posse, head over to github.com/sponsor/Cloud Posse. We appreciate all the support we can get. We spend a considerable amount of money and every little bit helps. So I appreciate it. Thanks, guys.
While we were just talking about the number five there, just really funny, I was just poking around at some of the hosts that they disclosed in some of these articles.
Yeah.
And it seems like a significant number of GitHub action runners, public action runners, are hosted on AWS.
So
even though Microsoft owns GitHub and owns Azure.
Yeah,
which is an interesting thing.
It is an interesting observation, and I noticed that the other day too, and I was wondering about that. I wonder why, because I know they made a big push to move to Kubernetes and I believe AKS, but that's about it.
Yeah, I guess not everything yet.
Yeah. Quick question. I don't want to sidetrack things, but does anybody know what the security considerations are for local runners?
Well, that's a great consideration. I mean, if you're using local GitHub runners backing public GitHub repos, whatever those runners can do, like if you're sharing those public runners to build stuff for your private repositories and infrastructure, like for example, a common pattern that we use is we deploy GitHub runners on-prem that have on AWS with service account roles that allow them to push to ECR, but you absolutely would never use those for public repos, those same runners. So if one is doing that, yeah, that's like the ultimate backdoor.
Well, if you are, put it in your own VPC that locks it down and make sure your default network policies are set to what it's allowed to talk to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think there's two criteria here, right? Number one is the pipeline code is part of the repository. And number two is they trigger automatically whenever a new merge request is submitted or a new commit is pushed. So whenever both of those are true, you're vulnerable regardless of where the actual runner is running.
Well, yeah, it's just that what are you giving to the runner? So like if that runner is in your walled garden, it's a bit of a different scenario in sure. the sense of the damage you can inflict. So
Yeah, I'm thinking more of that scenario, right? Like it's running in your walled garden because let's say you want to build something and you want to access resources internally, even if it's in your own like organization and not a public thing, it still seems to me like you have to be careful there.
Yeah. This is the dirty secret with CI or CD, right? I mean, you want to do automation. Ultimately, that automation is going to have the permission to do whatever you want to do. But yeah, it's not, let's just be fair to GitHub. That's not unique to GitHub and GitHub Actions.
Sure. Thanks.
Yeah. All right. All right, so we can get to the first question that I saw in the channel today. This was from Patrick Joyce, and I think it's a good one. There's a couple ways to address it here. Let me just open up the office hours channel. Yeah, so Patrick was just curious, you know, how do people manage the auto rotation of IAM user access keys within Terraform if we have time today? So I'd like to just start that the obvious answer, and I don't mean to be snooty, is you don't. You use STS, which is Amazon's API for automatically rotating credentials all the time. But I think what you're really asking is about the key pairs that you might be generating that are associated with an IAM user, and how do you rotate those programmatically? I guess there's two follow-up questions to that. First, Patrick, are you on the line?
Yeah. Yep.
Awesome. So yeah, then the follow-up question to that I have is, how are you using these key pairs? Are these for humans or are these for
these are
services?
Yeah, so I'm partially limited to what I can do because of the partition I'm in GovCloud. So gotcha. I'm limited to some of the things currently. And they're all service users because we do use SAML with Okta for people, for humans. So it's strictly like basically we use Git CI, so they're like pipeline service users. Yeah. Some of them may be like S3 bucket service users that only have permission to a certain bucket. And one of the things was I was looking at thinking about using like a Lambda, but once I rotate that cred, Terraform, and I delete the cred, then Terraform wants to recreate it because there's no lifecycle hook for like, you know, create once or ignore like lost resource or whatever. So, you know, and basically my Terraform module creates the service user. And then when it's done, it just dumps the creds into Vault. And every single thing that consumes that cred pulls it from the same Vault path so that it can be easily rotated.
Vault.
Yeah, exactly. Correct. Okay. Yep. So.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to, there's two things I can add to this, but it's not directly addressing your request. One is if you were humans who had this problem, just because other people might have this problem, and you're using IAM users with key pairs, then the I would say the best, still today, the best practice of doing that is with the CLI tool called AWS Vault, which will encrypt those key pairs in a secret in your keychain. And this command provides a tool, a subcommand to rotate those keys. This is not for you.
Yeah, we use Okta and they're short-lived, like 6 hours or 8 hour credentials.
But, so, but what you're talking about is what we call a system user here, or like a service user. These are actual IAM users used programmatically by other systems. These users are not using AWS Vault. They are other, it's like Circle CI or something like that. So how do you rotate those programmatically?
Yeah, so why not use the Vault AWS Secrets engine? It actually is designed specifically to do that. Like that's actually what it will do. It will rotate your keys for you automatically. Yeah, we are not in a position to do that, I guess, is a short answer of that. But that's a great idea.
I mean, that would be I would say that's the right answer, especially since you're a Vault shop. However, if there are things like you don't have Vault access or whatever to make those institutional changes, then I can understand that. That's why you don't do it.
That's exactly it. That's the only reason why we don't do that is we don't have permissions to alter the Vault engines and stuff like that. So
yeah, it sucks. And then you end up creating a less optimal Rube Goldberg Lambda.
Yep. Exactly. That's
well.
How many services?
So that's the thing. Is not many. You know, maybe like, I don't know, 12 service accounts or something like that.
So what I would do is, yeah, you can still keep creating the resource itself with IAM, the user, But the access resource you don't want to create with Terraform at all.
Gotcha.
Because then you have these issues tracking it. And then you'll have the Lambda that you deploy, which is creating the access key and rotating it probably and doing the rest of that stuff. So you're getting diminishing returns by forcing it into Terraform.
Yep.
So I've got this in my backlog right now, actually, to do, you know, something very similar. And what we decided we're going to do is rather than trying to solve the rotating automatically, we're just going to do automatic notifications of old keys, you know, and we're going to use Cloud Custodian to just automatically disable any key that's older than X days with email notifications. So, you know, it's not a fully automatic solution, but it's at least, hey, if you don't do anything about it, your key's going to get disabled 7 days from now. Go fix it. And since there's only 12, that's not a huge burden.
Yeah. And so I'm kind of leaning towards doing that at some point. Like my S3 service users are actually used for apps and deployment. So like I can't just rotate those without the app being redeployed. So that will have to be some sort of notification. Hey, like you have a week to update your app, whatever, you know, and then, yeah. But the service users, because they're all used in pipelines and pulled from one location, I mean, I could conceivably rotate those daily. But the only other idea I had to keep it in Terraform was to potentially add like maybe a S3 bucket object that was created by the Lambda and have Terraform. Yeah, I get this Goldberg thing end up happening.
Yeah.
And have Terraform check for the existence of that object or whatever and conditionally create the access key on whether the object existed or not. But yeah.
Do you have a fully GitOps driven workflow already in place?
Yes.
You do. What if you just, what are you using for CI?
GitLab.
GitLab, okay. I'm less familiar with GitLab. The construct must exist there. GitHub Actions, you can have a scheduled job. What if you just had a scheduled job?
That's exactly what I was thinking, a scheduled job. That like
paints this resource and just reruns the Terraform apply.
Yep. And so that would work beautifully. That's what I was thinking. Exactly. Every like 30 days, 90 days, whatever, taint the resource, reapply. And that would work fine for those service users. And the S3 bucket users, I couldn't do that, but that's a whole separate thing that's gonna have to be somewhat manual anyway.
Just cool. A quick question. Is this a situation where having two keys and rotating between them would be an easier Rube Goldberg to create?
I don't know if it'd be easier, but that's it. Actually, that's how the S3 bucket users are going to have to go, because I'm going to have to generate a new key while keeping the other key active. Then after they redeploy their app, then I can revoke the old key, because these are like productionized. I can't just revoke a key without.
It doesn't seem like rotation if you kill one first.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yes. Yep. Cool. Well, that that clarifies the route I was going. And hopefully at some point we can get our vault better situated.
Yeah, sounds good. Cool. Well, we didn't have too many questions piled up for today. Let me see here. If I go back while I look here, anybody else have any questions to cover?
I was just going to add one thing to what Patrick was saying there too. Like, consider if it's for user access to upload to S3 buckets that you're looking at there. Consider looking at pre-signed S3 URLs, which you can expire at various intervals as well. And you can just issue new ones that are signed again that have the rights to do what you need to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's applications that are programmatically, like they're accessing like PDFs and uploading PDFs and stuff like that. And gotcha. Ideally, I would use roles, but because of the way the apps are deployed, I can't use a role.
Got it. Yeah, got it. That makes sense.
All right. Let's see. So any announcements, any other interesting things that you guys have seen in the news? Amazon's been coming out with a lot lately.
Istio had kind of a weird security news item today. Let me see if I can find it. It was, if you upgrade from less than 1.5 to greater than 1.6, you potentially open yourself up to a vulnerability due to configuration changes. Here it is. I found it.
But 1.9 is the latest, right?
Oh, you would be so disappointed in me if I told you what version of Istio we're running.
Yeah, that's always the story with Istio, isn't it? In practice, everyone's
there it is.
Five major releases behind.
Well, they do a new one every 3 months, right? And they only... they're what? They support the last three versions, so you go deprecated every 9 months, no matter what?
Yeah. Just curious, has anyone given a shot to our tutorials lately? We have published under our docs a tutorial for getting started with Atmos. This is by Matt Gowie. So you can see how you can start using our YAML config format in your projects. And there's a pretty simple example to get you started under Cloud Posse tutorials. You can just clone this repo and you can run the second tutorial here. And it shows you how to write a simple stack configuration.
Yeah, I test this. Shout out to Matt. Pretty good actually stuff here. So yeah. Thank you, Matt.
Thanks for letting me know.
Did you guys look at Terraform or any further, like with Datadog and stuff?
Well, no, I don't think that it will fall into our workflow as a pattern for how to do things, but I do see it as a pretty interesting way to use it to generate, to get an idea of the Terraform code needed to support some operation that we would then put into a module. And yeah, no immediate use of that. Has anyone else given Terraformer a shot after we talked about it last week? How it supports tons of other providers other than GKE, AWS. It supports, you know, Datadog, Opsgenie, and others in it.
I found another interesting AWS news item that I thought was worthwhile mentioning. I think it was yesterday or maybe the day before, they announced that through the CLI and the SDK, they now give you the ability to copy an AMI to other regions. So for those of you that are building your own Packer AMIs, and before you had to build them in each region individually and publish them and all of that kind of thing, you can now build it in a master region and then copy it to any number of destination regions, which is pretty cool.
And that is cool.
Yeah. It's about time, including GovCloud, which I thought was interesting. So also for people who are also maintaining AMIs like in the marketplace, et cetera, this will make it much easier for them to do that and maintain them.
Yeah.
How does that work with if they're encrypted, like KMS encrypted, the EBS volumes? I guess that...
Yeah, I think there's a way that I saw there's a way you can decrypt it and then re-encrypt it like in the other region. I didn't look that deeply into the doc on it, but I did see something mentioned about that.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, in the past we've had to then distribute those without the encrypted EBS volume.
Yeah.
So. Hi, Eric, we had a couple of other questions in office hours. One was the chat ops oriented tooling conversation, and the other one was from Eric Berg on custom metrics.
Right. Oh yeah. And then we had a hot button or a popular topic last week I totally forgot about, which was talking more about how to track MTTR and what metrics we should be tracking in DevOps. All right, cool. Thanks for the reminder of that, Andy. Let's start over. So What was the first thing you said there, Andy? I forgot.
You pinned the message in office hours. It was from Thursday last week around chat ops.
All right.
Sheldon.
From Sheldon. Pinned message. What happened there? Sheldon. I'm not seeing it. I'm scroll back here pretty far. Can you read the question, Andy?
It's really more of a conversation. I'll send you the you pinned it in office hours though.
But from Sheldon?
Yeah.
Patrick, Bart, David.
Actually, I'm not seeing that he did pin it. Are you talking about the one about CTO.ai?
Yeah.
Oh, that was in general channel, I think. I think I said there that we should talk about it, but CTO.ai. I just posted the message in the channel. I didn't pin it, I don't think. Yeah. Pinned to channel. Let's see here. So Sheldon is taking a dive into chat ops oriented tooling rather than always having to do things in pipelines. For example, running on demand tasks and such. He says he's learned though that there's a negative cost to this when it's not your full time job to be a chat ops engineer. That you know. It can get complex and you have to keep it secured, the ease of use, and the underlying technology and chat ops changes. So he's been keeping an eye out on CTO.ai and it seems to offload a lot of that complexity. So you don't need to worry about that. I haven't spent time with CTO.ai myself. And I am curious about some of the bot or chat ops frameworks out there. I do identify with a lot of things you said, having done this at Cloud Posse. One of them is your chat ops start off real easy, as it did for us with the chat ops on all of our GitHub repositories. We have the commands like rebuild readme and slash test and you know some action. And it started off easy, and it's grown, and it's grown, and it's grown, and it's grown to something quite complex and difficult to maintain. So I relate to that. The other thing that I want to point out that I am not crazy about chat ops anymore to the degree I was crazy about it when I started. I would say, like, for many, Atlantis was our introduction to chat ops in a production-like way or, you know, high usage way. And it gets very noisy when everyone's typing all these chat op commands in your pull requests and you have all these machine generated comments and it takes away from the actual discourse happening in that pull request. I much prefer status checks and the status check API, if we're talking about GitHub for that information, or running GitHub actions and you see all the output there. But seeing lots of these chat commands in my pull requests, I'm not crazy about. And now, ChatOps is not relegated to GitHub, right? It's also for your, you know, you could be using it with Slack or GitHub team or Microsoft Teams as well. What I don't like about that as much is I feel like the UI for some of this stuff in Slack, it's just not the place for it. It's like it's a horrible UI. You can't control the look and feel of the messages and the responses and enrich them to the degree that it would be beneficial for all these use cases. So I think for simple things like triggering a deployment, yeah, maybe that's cool. But like I don't think it's a replacement for a well-designed web UI. And I don't think it's a replacement for a good CLI tool as well. Anybody really happy with their chat ops solution? Anybody already kicked the tires on CTO.ai or used it as like a, this framework? I think it's a weird domain given what their product does. All right, Sheldon, I don't really have too much to ask. Sheldon, are you on the call today or? All right. Andy, what was one of the other topic ideas you had brought up?
Sure. So next one was from Eric Berg on custom metrics. That was
in the morning. Yeah. Eric, you're on the call, right?
Yeah, I am. Hey.
Cool.
Sorry,
I missed your question here. I forgot to pin it.
No, I just asked it just a little while ago. But, you know, now that our Datadog infrastructure is pretty much all built out, we've got all of our tags set up, everything's in pretty good shape. Suddenly our developers, we're also like have a couple clients in production, which, you know, is very motivating to developers as well. Anyway, we're starting to instrument some of our applications, and some of the questions or the discussions that we're having are, you know, do we have one metric or do we also generate, you know, one metric? And then, for instance, have a status tag on there so that you can then like do the math in your monitors and things like in dashboards with those kind of queries. Or should you, I read somewhere somebody said you should at least have total and errors and an error count, like, you know, for a service or, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, we've all seen a variety of different kinds of metrics. You know, you get success, your error, total, like there's a bunch of a few ways to do it. I just wanted to see what, you know, what everybody has to say about that.
Yeah, basically, what is the schema of your metrics? There's multiple ways you can express it. Do you express those attributes as part of the key of the metric, like checkout total? Or are you just tagging some total with, I think it should be more specific. Metric names and how you tag it would be secondary to that. But disambiguating two metrics is totally separate. It seems.
One of the big benefits to, I think, having discrete metrics for related stuff is that, you know, like there's less math. There's just less code, fewer opportunities to screw up. And one of the big issues I feel with Datadog is that there's like 90,000 ways to get, you know, perspectives on all kinds of metrics. So consistency is really important. And you said something, I think, last week about your Datadog, about using templates. And that we did that at Grubhub. Some guys put together a really sharp template-based thing where we had a library of graphs and we could just be like, you know, your dashboard looked like something you could read. It was like import this guy, this guy, this guy. It was really cool.
Yeah.
That was very helpful.
Yeah, no, there are a few things I'm getting familiar with or comfortable with. And one is not necessarily related to Datadog, but just very wide tables. For like data warehouses, and it just by denormalizing everything, and it just makes everything easier when you have just discrete columns for everything. You can create views on the columns you want to see, and it's easier and faster to write and look up, and I don't know. So I guess the same thing would relate to Datadog. I think having the discrete lots of discrete metrics for what you're keeping track of, each with their specific type. Makes sense.
One more thing to add here is, should those be metrics? Like, are they actually a time series or are they just events that happen in time and right, putting them in a metric is the easiest way to do. Because Prometheus also has this problem, and Datadog and pretty much everybody, they do not support high cardinality. So in Prometheus, there was, I cannot remember, but there was a limit to how many combinations of time series and labels you could have. And it was pretty small. Because, yeah, you have a metric, and that's awesome. And you want to add the client ID to that metric. And then you want to add up the tenant ID or the workflow ID. And it gets very, very weird, and tools aren't built to handle that. This is going to sound very pitchy. I'm not affiliated with them. Honeycomb is the only company that actually does that. They build their own query engine to be able to support these super high cardinality, super detailed events, and they can show metrics. But from what you've been saying with success and error and things like that, those sound more like they should be events, maybe traces, so you could filter on those.
Yeah. This is a good point. I think also price spikes up with Datadog if you have high cardinality too. So
that can happen with individual metrics or tag metrics, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, they both count similarly. Although it's like checkbook math. It's kind of math, but you can't exactly figure it out the calculator.
Yeah.
It's very annoying. They went from host-based pricing was shipped, because it basically encouraged you to use big fat machines to lower your monitoring bill, which was not good. And now everybody moved to, Datadog moved to, we're only going to let you have a couple of tags and not really get benefits. I mean, it's awesome for CPU and memory and RAM, like network for all of those. It's awesome. For anything else, it's severely limiting.
So should we start talking about the metrics for DevOps? And I'm really curious to learn what metrics everyone is tracking today. And so DevOps is a little bit overloaded here, but what metrics is everyone tracking today across multiple systems, Jira, your CI, possibly like GitHub Actions or GitLab Runners, your continuous deployment and continuous delivery. I'm curious, what are the tools you're using? What are the metrics you're looking at?
Well, one example I'll offer is using New Relic. We track, New Relic is our kind of centralized incident and alert reporting, and all of that goes into PagerDuty. And so we, for our incidents, we track them, P1, P2, P3, P1 being the higher severity. And so we track how many production level incidents have happened, P1, P2, and how many non-production incidents have happened, P3, P4. And we've got a pretty nice New Relic dashboard that says, days since last production incident. Mm. If you can imagine, like, it's kind of modeled off of the whole OSHA thing, like days since last, OSHA infraction or something like that. So we try to keep, production instances or incidents to a minimum, if at all possible. The non-production ones, those kind of fluctuate because developers are in there, they're doing whatever they need to do, and they break stuff. But we want to keep days since production incidents zero, as often as we can.
That's obviously really good. And that's a pretty conventional metric to look at in your PagerDuty or your Ops Genie dashboards, in this case, in New Relic. Now, I'm curious, are there other metrics you're also looking at? And are you bubbling up these metrics across multiple products in any one dashboard?
No, not collectively. Yeah, and that's like part of the I won't say the issue, but it's like it offers some short-sightedness, because we see that production, incident rate, but we don't see it as it relates to particular applications or all applications as a whole. We can't see the hotspots.
And this is the problem that I feel like we face, is that we have all these data silos. Like in New Relic, we see a little bit of this stuff going on, and then over here on in Jenkins, we see these builds failing, but there's no aggregate view of the state of the union of services. Last week, I forget who it was recommending, trying to export all this stuff and get it into Prometheus, for example. And that's not a bad idea if you're already probably using Prometheus. And then someone else recommended, there are all these, I forget what they're called, the exporters from Elasticsearch that you can use to export data from different systems and consume it into
Beats.
Elasticsearch.
Beats.
Problem is that you cannot consume it. It's useless if you have metrics and just try to look at metrics without context. Oh my God, the number of requests tripled. That's terrible. We should look into that. Oh, we're actually running a marketing campaign. That's totally normal. The metrics are absolutely useless without context and without humans. And SLIs and SLOs fix that. But implementing that is a whole culture change that is not easy to do and doesn't easily work on migrating Nagios to Prometheus.
And I know, Vlad, you're right about that. I mean, and it's not enough just to have them without context. But I think, and this is my very pragmatic approach to life and business, is let's solve what we can solve to start with and take baby steps to get there. And one is that, like, and we're doing this at Cloud Posse, is we need to start with just getting the metrics. Let's just start collecting the data somewhere in a place that we can report on it in one place, because we have these silos. And like you said, like, yeah, requests tripled, but we had this marketing campaign. That's great. But that can also be, you know, that can be on a similar dashboard, right? Like, you see ad spend spikes, request spikes. And I think some of this stuff you learn as you go, what starts working, and going straight into the SLI, SLO can be a bit daunting. I feel like that's why people probably don't even get to implementing it, because they don't even know how to take the first step to getting there. So,
yeah, it's easier making all the mistakes. But for the example with requests, you're going to saying that you can have both requests and ad spend on a dashboard is going to lead to dashboards with 3,000 different lines. And you're trying to find the squiggly bump in all the graphs.
You are.
That's not something that's developer friendly. And I agree.
You are doing that, but it's this, what I find is it's this evolution. Like, and what you described is my problem totally. I have these, I use Metabase. I have all these dashboards and they grow with widgets and widgets and widgets and widgets. And it gets overwhelming because at different times I'm looking for different things, different indicators, basically.
Find them different squiggly.
Yeah, but I feel like there's all I'm calling a lot of these stall indicators. I'm looking for all the possible stall indicators I have in the business, and that's kind of what I'm looking for in a DevOps in terms of like engineering organization. What are the stall indicators in an engineering organization so you can see that, you know, where you're suffering? Time to close pull requests is spiking, or deployment error rates are spiking, or deployment times are taking too long. I'm torn because there's these, like, Amazon is launching these what do they call, like, insights, or these specialized AI services to help you understand the insights in your data, and that's great. But at the same time, it's frustrating because we're getting more and more detached from the data and what it means. So I don't know.
DevOps Guru is in preview, isn't it?
It's DevOps.
Seeing which squiggly line is weird.
Yeah. And the end result of what I'm saying is, I feel like it's kind of meta, but you're going to have these specialized services that are giving you some stuff, some data, but there needs to be, I feel, at a company level, a superset of all the systems where you have a way to aggregate that data into a warehouse of some sort and report on it.
Yeah, to Vlad's point, I was asked to provide this data one time by a CTO, because he kept hearing complaints like, it's taking too long to turn around requests and issues aren't getting closed. And when I actually ran the reports, you know, the average time to close an issue is like 2 weeks. Terrible from his point of view. But when you actually looked at the requests that were, or the issues that were urgent, the response time was extremely quick. So that delineation is really important, and it's not always trivial to parse it out from your whole data set.
Yeah.
I'm also very, so I want to make this clear, I'm very, very, very privileged in my position. So I work to get companies to be super high performing, which means that I see what the top performers do and how they behave. Mm-hmm. And I, when I usually work with a client, I have that buy-in that, yes, we desperately need to fix this now. It's burning. We're going to do whatever it takes. And it's, there's such a huge, huge difference between the top performing companies that deliver fast, super awesome software, and the rest that it's mind-boggling.
That is probably, I mean, I agree with that statement. Now,
implementing that for
what are they looking at? What are the top performers looking at? How do they get there? How do they know what the metrics are that make up their KPI? I guess that's what I want to understand.
Which Google fucked, excuse my language. Can we swear on this stream? I mean, it's recorded.
It's recorded for what it's worth.
But... Yeah, I think it's all just general practice. You know, usually, so I'm originally from Florida, where we heard that the Silicon Valley had the kind of the one size fits all solutions for technology. So when I got to the West Coast, it was in reality, it was the actual implementation or the solutions that you build out that kind of drives what the rest of the industry is consuming. So it really comes through experience. So.
Andrew, I think you have a lot of background noise right now. I apologize. It's kind of hard to hear.
Oh yeah, my airport headphones. Yeah.
There was the DORA report, so the Accelerated State of DevOps report, that basically tracked these metrics and showed exactly what you need to optimize. But Google bought them and they didn't do anything, and it was one of the biggest hits to DevOps in the last year. DORA report. I can share the PDF in the office hours because you have to put in your email to download it. But what they did was they ran for 7 years. I might be wrong. The second link. And you should be able to download the PDF somewhere.
This one here?
They basically ran for 5 to 7 years. High chance I'm wrong on that. And they discussed and tracked a bunch of companies. I think it was 13,000 companies, something like that. You can just fill in gibberish here. And they basically looked at all these companies, how are they delivering, what their performance is, and they built some very gorgeous reports on what was actually, what seemed to have an impact. And they did that for a bunch of years. They showed very graphs, how it was evolving, what people were moving, and it was super, super, super awesome. And Google bought them, and yeah, it went away. And yeah, the very annoying thing is that the 2018 and previous reports, like, they aren't exactly shown in the 2019 report. So the report is per year and they do showcase trends. But if you just start reading from the oldest to the newest report, you'd see that.
Mm.
And yeah, this was very hard data with a bunch of respondents from many company sizes, many industries all over the globe and all that. And it was, this is what you need to do to actually become high performing.
So tracking lead time, change fail, availability, deployment frequency, time to restore.
They have on page 31, I think, this report, there should be a very big graph with what impacts what. Yeah. Mm. Oh my God, I actually know this report, but I'm going to be concerned about that later. So yeah, they basically go in.